Welcome to Good Calls with Dean Blandino, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, what's up? Dean Blandino. Welcome to another episode of Good Calls with me, Dean Blandino. Today, as always, Travis Hanson sitting in his backyard, his beautiful backyard that I've yet to see. Travis, what's up?
What's up, man? Good to see you.
Not much. Joe, what's your background there?
It's from the office.
Remember? You're a big office guy?
Yeah, I'm a huge office guy.
You're a huge office guy? Mm-hmm. Is that
you remember that's where they go
is
and
that
sit down?
Stanley?
Yeah, that's Stanley behind me. Yeah. But this is where they go and they just talk in front of the camera. Yeah.
Got it. And we've got a friend of the show joining us, been on the show before, Scott Tamil. Scott, your background is much more interesting. That I believe is the Cisco video for the Thong Song. I believe is that correct?
That is right. I respect Cisco. I respect his music abilities and his how he brought the Thong Song back, or how he brought thongs into the mainstream.
And everybody then started talking about thongs. And for those of you that don't know, this is the four of us are basically in this Fox Sports studio. Pretty much it feels like we're together a lot during football season. We're there Friday night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. And this is the dream team. So when you see me on the air giving some amazing rules analysis, this is the team behind me. These are the guys behind the guy. And I wouldn't be able to do my job. I would be able to do my job without them. But
it just wouldn't be as fun.
They make it enjoyable. We have a lot of conversations and we talk about a lot of things. And so we're going to jump right into it today. And obviously, look, we're not, you know, we don't deal with politics on this show and stuff, but there's stuff happening in the country right now that, you know, I don't know if in my lifetime, and I'm the oldest, if I've experienced, you know, a combination of things like this all at once in this country. You think about the pandemic, COVID-19, and now what's happening with the protests, obviously stemming from the death. And I'm not, look, it was a murder on video of George Floyd in Minneapolis, in terms of, you know, an unarmed black man getting killed by the police, and the protests and the rioting and everything else. What the hell is going on right now? Like what, Scott, you're from Minnesota. You're from Minneapolis. What's happening in Minneapolis? Obviously we see these images around the country. What's going on?
Well, I will, you know, right away say, a lot of my friends, I went to school at the University of Minnesota. So a lot of my friends, I still have a lot of friends, a lot of family in the Twin Cities. They live, a good number of them that I've been in touch with the last few days, they live, you know, a lot of, for lack of a better term, where the action is like off of Lake Street, which is like a main through street through most of Minneapolis. And, you know, they live like, you know, one block away, two blocks away. Obviously, people probably saw the third precinct was burned down. And then the fifth precinct was a center point for demonstrations on like the following days. And I have a friend who, you know, he just had a kid. He lived like a block or two away from the fifth precinct. So they were like, hey, you know, it's like they weren't necessarily afraid. They weren't afraid that like their house was going to get burned down or anything, but that they just were like, you know, if we need to go because something with the baby, we can't get trapped here because if there's people in the street or if there is a curfew, you know, and we're not allowed to leave, you know, so, it's been a scary time.
Look, I get it. And I get the messaging. I get the exchange of ideas on social media. I'm really not one for, I don't like, you know, being a social media activist and posting something because everybody's posting it and then going about my business and not really caring. Just, I've made that statement on social media and I've seen, you know, people doing that. And I saw one video, this young girl jumps out of her car and this guy was boarding up the building, whatever business he had, he was boarding it up, and she asked him if she could take a picture with the drill like she was doing it, and her friend took a picture, and they were going to post that on Instagram like, we're helping rebuild the community. And that bothers me. But I think the bigger question, and you see this a lot, there's a lot of people out there, there's a lot of white people. Look, there three of us here, we're white, and we're questioning, okay, how can we help? Like, what do we do? Like, I see a lot of white people asking that. And I see a lot of black people giving advice on social media. And I've watched a lot of videos, and it's like, look, because the bottom line is this will calm down. And then I'm going to go on about my business. I'm still going to be white. Right. So how do we affect change? Because this has been going on, right, for a very long time. And we are talking about, when you think of names like Emmett Till and then Amadou Diallo and Eric Garner and Trayvon Martin and George Floyd. I mean, this isn't a new thing. And so is this the tipping point where we're finally going to, you know, affect that change? And how do we do it? Like, I've listened to a lot of people. I understand in terms of we've got to vote. We've got to get the right people in office. We've got to protest. We've got to petition our local governments and affect this change at the local level and at the state level. I just, you know, it's so hard. It's just, it's so crazy to think about what's going on in the middle of a pandemic. It's almost as if people have kind of not forgotten, but it's kind of been pushed on the back burner in terms of COVID, with everybody out and the social distancing and we're all together. It just feels surreal at times.
Yeah. As you're watching the news, I was watching the news last night, and Dr. Drew's on there saying, are we going to see a spike now in the COVID? And you hope we don't, because these people are out doing these demonstrations, and all the peaceful protests are great. And it's sad to see what's lost with the looters and them bringing their actions into it and completely going against what the protesters are doing. And that's what's sad to me. So it's interesting to see if we will see a spike in the COVID, and you hope not.
Well, and the thing is about, right, the looters. So I live in Santa Monica. We're all in LA, and Sunday there was protests in Santa Monica. You guys have been here. I live a couple blocks from the beach and a block from the promenade. The promenade was a key point, and there were people looting, and there were people peacefully protesting. And so I was out on my balcony, just kind of, you know, Sunday evening, sitting out, just watching what was going on. And there were kids, you know, black, white, Hispanic, you know, all races, running past with, you know, boxes of Nike shoes, you know, so maybe the Nike store got broken into. I haven't been down there that far. But, you know, running by. And then, so I kind of, you know, you watch this happen, you know, in front of you, and this is the reality of it. And I went back inside, and then maybe about 20 minutes later, I hear the lady upstairs from me. I live in a condo, and the lady upstairs from me yelling something. And she has this nice Hispanic lady that lives above me, and she's yelling across the street, and I can't make out what she's saying. So I go out, and she's yelling at these kids, and she's saying, go get away from there, I'm going to report you. And they had broken into the restaurant across the street from me, broken the glass doors, and were in the restaurant. They kind of reacted to her. They got out of there. They started walking. Their car was parked right across the street from my building. And I just went out there, and I was looking to see what was going on. And the one kid was yelling up at the lady, saw me and started yelling at me. And, you know, white people, you don't know what we go through. And I started to have a conversation. I tried to say, hey, what are you guys doing? You know, just to get his thoughts, like what's happening? Let's talk about this, like trying to have a conversation. And he started to open up. Look, I'm angry. I live in the hood. I come here. I see how you people live. And it was very like, you know, it makes me, you know, he was upset and his friends were upset. And so we're having this conversation, and then this other car pulls up and this guy gets out, and I don't know how he knew we were having a conversation, and we're yelling because he was far away. He just gets out, looks up, and he's like, go back in your house, F you, white person, you effing fascist. And I'm just like, whoa, like what is that about? I was like, look, no one's talking to you. We're having a conversation, but like, I get it. Like, I get the anger. I get the frustration. And you can't say, look, when you talk about the violence that erupts, when people are angry and frustrated, think about your own life, right? Emotions sometimes don't know what they're doing, right? Emotions don't understand their actions. When you're emotional, sometimes you react. You see people, whether it's grief or anger. And so you're talking about, with the Black community, right? This is hundreds and hundreds of years, right? Of built up frustration. And you can't just say, this is the thing, like, you can't just say, okay, right, we end slavery, 1865, Emancipation Proclamation, you're all free. All right. Or in the 1960s, the civil rights movement, now you have the full rights of all Americans. Okay, go be free. Go, like, they're starting. Like, we, as a white person, we have a head start. Well, it's a reality.
I think too, just to make sure things are framed in the is that, you know, you mentioned there's like famous or infamous incidents, whether it is this most recent one or, you know, Trayvon Martin or something. It's like, when you see this as a single entity incident, it sticks out for it. It's like, that's how a lot of people consume it. It's like, oh, this tragic story here. But to hear, you know, friends of mine speak about this as well, is that it's like, this isn't just a single one. So this, Floyd, like, this is just stacking another on a long legacy, a historical legacy. And then when it comes to people talking about if you're trying to delineate between who are the right protesters, who are the ones who are looting, who are the thing that I think, we bring up COVID too, this is something that I do think is forgotten a little bit, is that as we see COVID play out over the last couple months, the burden of that, the burden of who has to be out, like who can't work from home,
sure,
is lower income people, because yep, they're working those jobs that are deemed necessary to keep the economy rolling. And I think the interesting thing about some of these protests are that they are taking place now in the past, like when we're talking historically, whether it's the 92 LA riots, whether it's, well, when we're talking about LA, the Watts riots, also with after MLK Jr. was assassinated, there were riots, there were protests all over America. They were largely contained to areas that African Americans were allowed to live in. And now what you're seeing is, you know, it's in Soho, they're in Santa Monica, they're in Beverly Hills. And I think part of that, not to confuse these issues, but it is kind of a culmination of pressure building. And when 100%. It pops, when it blows, in this instance, there's more grievances than a narrow issue. And it always is, but you see it now. And I think that's also why people in general are responding a little differently, because I do know, because I had relatives who lived in West LA during the riots, the 92 LA riots. It's like, there was a very conscious effort by this city to be like, yes, this is in South Central. Yes, this is in K-Town, but we are not letting them march into Beverly Hills. We are not letting this get west of the 405. Mm-hmm. And now, because these things are happening, I think there's a different urgency, unfortunate or not, that when it's in power brokers' backyards, it's a little scarier for them. They're not just like, hey, it's over here.
You're making people uncomfortable, and that's what has to happen. We have to have uncomfortable conversations. We have to have uncomfortable situations. And this is bigger. This is not about, I named a couple of names. This is bigger than those instances, because this is about systemic racism. This is about discrimination that happens. I don't know what it's like. I'm not Black. I don't know what it's like. I can live my life unconsciously throughout the day, right? I can walk into a store and not have to think about I'm going to be approached differently or I'm going to be looked at differently, right? I hate we have these words and we have these phrases, right? White privilege, right? Well, everybody throws around white privilege and everybody argues the debate about what is white privilege and all this stuff. And people get offended. White people say, well, I'm not privileged. I worked it for everything that I have and I grew up with nothing. And nobody's saying that you didn't work hard and nobody's saying that you were given all these things. But if there is such a thing as white privilege, I believe that there is, whatever you want to call it. It's that as a white person, as a white man, I was never held back because of the way I looked. Mm-hmm. My skin color didn't hold me back. I wasn't looked at differently. I wasn't treated differently. I wasn't denied opportunities because of my skin color. And that's a privilege. Like I said, I can walk through life unconsciously and not have to think about things that a black man has to think about. And that's the reality. And that has to be frustrating on a daily basis to have those interactions and to feel like that. And that builds and builds and builds. And I think, Scott, you hit the nail on the head. That's important that this is different than Rodney King and Watts and these other, you know, protests and riots and things like that, because they're happening in white people's neighborhoods and they're happening and it's making people uncomfortable. And maybe that's what needs to happen for real change to happen.
And it was really a perfect storm. I mean, all the pressure valves were tied up. Like, you couldn't go to the gym, you couldn't go to church, you couldn't leave, you know, the quarantine, and people were already on edge. And now it's just like, screw it, man. You know, like there's just nothing to relieve a little bit of the pressure every single day for the last 3 months.
I think you're 100% right, where this is there's a lot going on in the country where, with COVID, which, as you said, has like closed down a lot of things, and the people who are being, you know, who are shouldering the largest burden are minority communities, ones who can't afford to be out of work that also is because a lot of them are now also unemployed. Like, there's this large amount of people that are unemployed. There's a large amount of people who are—they're scared. People are scared. They're angry. It's a bunch of things. And
it's like the looters. You have the opportunists, is what they're calling themselves. You know, they're not out there to protest. They're not about the cause. They're just out there to try to come up on some money and be able to sell some stuff. And that's unfortunate.
I think there's always going to be people like that. We're always going to have whatever you want to call them, opportunists and things like that. And I think, but there's just so much. Look. The media and ultimately, right, I'm part of the media. We're all part of the media, right, to some extent. But I feel like there's still a lot of misinformation out there. It's really tough to understand, because you say, okay, you know, now you hear about, right, there's peaceful protests, and then there's whether it's an alt-right group or something that is there to try to make it look like the protesters are violent and destroying property and looting and doing things like that. It's so complicated. And ultimately, what we really need in this country is we need leadership. We need people with a voice to stand up and to speak. We need to educate ourselves, especially for me, like what I'm as a white man, I'm going to, you know, continue to try to educate myself about whether it's Black history, the civil rights movement, things that, you know, talk to my Black friends, have those conversations. And we need to be exposed to that. We need to have compassion and empathy. And these are not easy. You know, when you're sitting there and I'm having a conversation with my 9-year-old, because he sees what happened and he's watching the news, and he asked me about Rodney King and he asked me about the riots back then and what is police brutality, Dad, and what is, you know, what happened to George Floyd and why are people, you know, why are people protesting and why are people rioting? You kind of have to break it down when you talk to a kid and try to explain to them that, look, it's not, you know, there are people that are peaceful, that are protesting, white, Black, Hispanic, Asian, whatever it may be. And people are angry and people are frustrated because ultimately not everybody in this country is treated the same. And there are people that have privilege. I'm one of them. And we kind of got to work through it. We got to stand up and make some change. And hopefully, you know, this is one where we don't find ourselves everybody falling back into their own comfort zone. And then it takes another, you know, another unarmed man, you know, being killed. And the thing is, and look, and the other thing is, I just want to say, like, police officers have a hard job, right? They deal with stuff on a daily basis that we don't have to deal with, right? That we don't have to have those interactions. They're dealing with people, good people, bad people, people that commit crimes, people that are, you know, and their job is to keep people, you know, keep the community safe. So they have a tough job. And just like anything else, though, you know, when you watch that video, though, it's impossible. It's impossible to sit there and say that was justified. And that doesn't mean we can't cast blame on the entire police community, because there are an overwhelming number of officers, our good officers, that are there to help, just like any other group of people. And there are going to be good people and there are going to be bad people. So it's just, we got to continue to educate ourselves and have those conversations.
The hope here is that in this day and age, with everyone using their platforms now, in the 90s, you didn't have the biggest stars going out and talking about these hard issues. You didn't have Michael Jordan, the biggest star in 92, talking about the riots. Now you have LeBron James and other athletes who are coming out and standing up for these their rights. And hopefully this opens those conversations and more powerful people are able to keep the conversation going and things will get done.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important to right now listen and acknowledge, but, you know, we've said this already, but just, you can't stop there, which is just like, wow, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anyways.
Right.
And then
that's
the
thing. Like, that's the thing. That's what I think, though. I can acknowledge my white privilege, and then I can go about just being white and not worrying about.
Yeah. And then I think too, like you were saying though, is like with what Travis, what you just said with the athletes and stuff, is like the important message though is a lot of times in America, we talk about, you know, the cliche of like lifting yourself up by your own bootstraps. Like, hey, I'm going to work hard. And then you think kind of you hit a level of like, in general, we measure it by economic class, like I made my money. So we look at pro athletes as that. But the message that they're saying, which is important too, since this is a sports podcast, you know, we're talking about athletes, is we know even with that status, or it's an African American celebrity, it's not necessarily they're an actor, yep,
you're still black
and you are still viewed with suspicion, yep, because yep, we've had NBA players, NFL players who have had like been wrongfully arrested, you know, and then you have situations like I can't remember his name now, but like, yeah, regardless, it's just something where it doesn't matter how much money you make, they will always feel like they are viewed with suspicion. I mean, a great example, although this didn't happen in the United States, I believe it was in France, but when
Oprah.
Yeah, they were like, I don't, it's like the one of the like highest profile women,
one of the richest people on the planet. And they wouldn't let her into some high end boutique in Paris.
Yeah,
because of the color of her skin.
They're just like, right? Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, arguably one of the like the most influential women of our society, of our, you know, lifetime. It's crazy. How do they?
No, I think back. I remember one of my friends who lives in Chicago, who ended up getting a big job, making a lot of money, and he moved to this Lake Forest area in Illinois, which is near where the Bears train. And I remember we were all sitting around and he was talking about the people that lived in his community. And Michael Jordan had a house there. And there were several other high profile Bulls, Bears, all black. Right. And he was explaining to us, you know, to show how high profile and how high end this neighborhood was. And my other friend just said, oh, so you live in a black neighborhood, you know, like that's the idea. That it doesn't matter what status you make as an athlete, and that's why it's important to hear that there's still, you know, there's still discrimination regardless. Because people will sit here and say, what do you have to worry about? You're LeBron James or you know, whoever it is. You don't have to worry about anything. And the reality is, yeah, they do.
Yeah.
And we don't understand that. And that's the crazy part about all this.
Yeah.
All right. I think we've hit this. Let's take a break. We come back, we're going to talk NFL rules changes, and we're going to see, get some updates on when we can see other sports like the NHL, the NBA, Major League Baseball return next on Good Call. All right, we're back on Good Calls. Let's talk NFL rules changes a little bit later this year, thanks to COVID-19. Usually this would be decided in March. League meeting was pushed back. NFL membership had a virtual meeting last week on Thursday, and they reviewed several rules proposals. Let's go through what passed, okay? So they made the automatic review of all tries, regardless of what is ruled, and scoring plays and turnovers that were negated by penalty, they made that permanent. That was a one-year change last year. It was part of the PI review proposal. We'll get to PI review in a second. So that's a permanent change. All that means is on any try play, if there's any question, anything that's reviewable, it would be an automatic review. The replay official would have to stop the game. The coach can't challenge it. And then any score that is negated by a penalty. The Chargers score a touchdown, but there's holding on the left tackle. Anything that would be reviewable, because there was a score during the down, even though it was eventually negated, it would be up to the replay official, so the coach doesn't have to challenge it. Doesn't happen very often. So that was the one change that passed in terms of replay. They expanded the protection for a defenseless player to include the kick returner, who caught the kick, and they extended it to give him time to protect himself. So in the past, punt returner, kickoff returner, more punt returner, because that's where the contact is more likely. He was protected up until he caught the ball. Receiver protected a little bit longer. Receiver can catch the ball and then has to clearly establish himself as a runner, be able to protect himself. So they extended that protection that the receiver gets to the kick returner. So now the kick returner, the punt returner, catches it. The moment he catches it, if he's hit in the head neck area, it would be a foul for a hit on the defensive player. He actually has to protect himself. And then the last change that passed, this was the Bill Belichick did it to the Jets, and then Mike Vrabel did it to Bill. And this was the successive fouls that bled the clock in the fourth quarter. The offense is ahead. They're about to punt. They take a delay of game. Play clock goes to 25, runs down another 25, then they false start. The league changed the rule to say that those fouls now in the fourth quarter, the fouls that prevent the snap, the false start, the delay game, offensive fouls, would now, the clock would start on the snap. So you can't take an additional 40 seconds, an additional 25 seconds off the clock in those situations. So those were the three that passed. Nothing earth-shattering there. I don't think there's anything major there. The one that got tabled, which was the interesting one, which is Travis's favorite rule change proposal of all time, is the onside kick alternative. Look, he's getting – I wish you could see him now. He just smiled. He hasn't smiled. He didn't smile once during the civil rights conversation, but now he's smiling because of his onside
kick. That's a heavy talk. This topic is great because it's something that could change the game, and it makes things different, makes things chaotic in the game that we love. And it gets people just riled up about, the game can't change. The classic fans don't want to see any changes. And I think it
can you lay out exactly what this change is, though?
Just Travis, I didn't hear a word you said because I'm too busy watching the Aha Take on Me video behind Scott.
I know. Scott and these moving backdrops.
No, it's one of the best videos of all time. So here's the proposal. And this was proposed last year, something similar by Denver last year. Philadelphia proposed it this year. It was kind of dead. There wasn't a lot of talk about this. And then a couple of weeks before the meeting, it started to build some momentum. And that momentum, that was momentum that was really being pushed from the league office, right? And you had people at the league office, higher ups, I'm not going to name names, but they really wanted this to pass. They thought that this would infuse some excitement at the end of the game. And honestly, this was, when you talk about what's happening around the NFL, and this was before, right? This was before the protests and everything, and obviously COVID-19, but you had PI Review dying a really ugly, ugly death. You have the whole minority hiring process system that a lot of people think is broken. And they really, I think, felt that this would be a positive coming out of this meeting to say, hey, look, we're being innovative. We're changing the game for the better, and we're going to make it more exciting. The alternative is, so the rule was basically anytime during the game, right, a team could elect, in lieu of a kickoff, they could elect a 4th and 15. And that 4th and 15 would be one play from the 25-yard line. And if they got a first down, they would keep the ball and could continue the drive. And it was just going to be like a normal play, other than it was going to be an untimed down. So late in the game, we're behind. We want an onside kick. We could choose to go 4th and 15 and run one offensive play. And if we got a first down, the drive would continue. If we scored a touchdown, great. We scored a touchdown. That's the rule change. It was discussed at length. The language was amended actually before the meeting because there was some concerns about it was originally designed to be a timed play. And what teams thought of is, you know, I'm up, I score the game winning touchdown, or I'm still up, they score a touchdown, the team that's behind. Here's the deal. We score a touchdown to go up. All right, we take the lead. There's 3 seconds left. We're going to kick off. Instead of a kickoff, I'm going to run my 4th and 15. I'm going to take the snap. I'm going to roll out to the right, and I'm going to throw the ball downfield as far as I can and run out the clock. I don't even have to worry about a kickoff. So that concern led them to go with an untimed down. It was 16-16 in the room. So they did like a kind of a straw poll, and it ended up being 16-16. You need 24 to vote yes in order for to change to pass. So they tabled it. And when they table it, that means that they're going to try to work it and try to get the additional 8 votes that they need to get this.
Do you know what it was last year when it was talked about?
Wasn't 16. I don't think they had, I don't think there was as many as 16. Might have been 12 or 13 yeses. Yeah. So look, the bottom line is it's an interesting alternative. I don't hate it. I like anything that's going to create a more exciting game, going to allow teams to come back. I still think it's a fundamental change to the game. And whenever you're going to make a fundamental change to the game, you need to make sure that you vet out the unintended consequences. And you think about all the things that could happen. This isn't a player safety change. There's no data that says 4th and 15 is more or less safe than an onside kick, right? Mm-hmm. It just, they don't have that information. And so this is strictly trying to make the game more exciting, but I'll ask you, you guys are fans, you watch enough football. Does the NFL have an excitement problem?
I don't think so.
Not in this instance for this specific set. Also, I think 4th and 15 these days, like, I think that's not that hard to convert.
Yeah, what do we have the percentage of what 4th and 15
I'd say,
plays,
you know,
are?
4th and 15, when we did it, we
thought it was like 20
up,
something.
No, it's less than that. The onside kick historically is you know, somewhere around 10%, maybe 12% success. It dropped well below that in 2018. That's why these conversations are happening. Now when you think about the you know, the first person that brought this up was Greg Schiano when Greg Schiano was at Rutgers. And Greg brought this up because of player safety. Again, this has not been brought up for player safety. And Greg brought it up for player safety.
The onside kick, though, right?
What's that?
That was before they changed the rule of the onside kick where guys can't run up. So they changed that to for player safety.
But that was from, if you remember, back in it was the mid-2000s, Eric LeGrand, who's a Rutgers player, was paralyzed on a kick return. And making a tackle and was paralyzed. And so we started, you know, Greg was the one that really pushed this idea of this alternative. And, you know, it got some attention then. It kind of died down. They made some significant changes to the kickoff on both sides of the ball. And now we're back. I like the onside kick because the onside kick was a tactic that teams created within the existing rule. Right. The existing rule was that the ball was a live ball once it went 10 yards. That was the rule, the kickoff rule for forever. And so teams came up, they were creative, and they came up with this tactic within the existing rule. Now you're just creating something artificially to say, we want to be more exciting. We want teams to have that opportunity. The other thing is a kickoff, right? On a kickoff, the kicking team can't recover it and advance it. Fourth and 15, you catch a pass, you're gone, you got a touchdown. So we don't want to make it too easy for teams to come back. I don't know. I like the onside kick where it is. I think it's a very skilled play. Joe, being a part-time amateur kicker, can understand that. And
can we discuss again Joe's idea and his kicking ability that he thinks he can?
Well, we came up with another one, but Joe thinks he can kick a 35-yard field goal. He's just cold, no warm-up. He's going to kick a 35-yard field goal.
And Joe, how long have we been talking about that? And how long?
Since the beginning.
About do it. Well, this 9, 10 months now, right?
Well, this is the 37th episode, so 37 weeks.
38?
Yeah. 38. Long time.
No, but long before that, we were talking about making these
Dean knows. He knows I could do it. He's just...
Well, Joe, a couple of things. Joe, if he were 4 inches taller, he'd be an NFL tight end. And we determined that if he was 100 pounds lighter, he'd be a UFC fighter.
I've never heard that side of it. That's a good
one. Yeah, we just came up with that one.
He would dominate like the bantamweight or featherweight division.
Let me just explain something to all you guys. No matter what I do, Dean has to be on the opposite side. That's just how he is. He's just like, oh, this guy's too confident. I gotta knock him down a little bit. So he knows I could kick the field goal.
Wait, Travis is so confident. I'm always busting his chops. Travis isn't like a guy.
Whatever it is, it's just, you just have to bust people. That's, you're Italian, and that's what Italians do. That's how you guys show love, and I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. If I don't bust your chops, that means I don't like you. Indifference, right? What's the opposite of love? It's not anger. It's indifference.
It's like old coaches would tell you, if I'm not trying to help you, then I've given up on you. And so
the criticism is great. I've never heard that, Travis. That is not a saying that coaches say ever.
A coach hasn't said that. Are you kidding me?
That is not.
No.
When you think about great quotes by coaches, what is it again? What's the great quote?
I paraphrase it. Coaches, so this is maybe more high school, not so much for like high elite athletes.
Get ready, kids.
Me to continually give you criticism and help you because that means I still care about you. And
that's the worst quote ever. If you're gonna drop a quote, it's gotta be like, right? Winning, what is the Lombardi quote, right? Winning isn't the everything, is the only thing.
Yeah.
Right? It's gotta be something like that. Succinct, to the point. What did you just say?
I missed the mark. Sorry.
I have no idea.
I just needed you to make fun of me more. That's all.
You do. That's how these are like my children, and they're like, oh, he's not making fun of me. Joe doesn't care anymore. When Joe thinks I don't care, he'll wear some ridiculous outfit to the studio.
How about those flat pants that time?
He knows I'll make fun of him. That's what he'll walk in and he'll stand there and wait for me. And I'll be like, what? He's like, what? What? I'm just standing here in my leopard pants.
I just like to give you ammo.
Exactly.
I know. Real quick though, wouldn't the, just about the onside kick. So if they do a 4th and 15, I feel like the reason why I said like the percentages might jump too is because it's like, well, you're probably going to pass. So there could be a pass interference.
Well, that's
like, what happens there?
100%. Like, a hold? An official thinks he sees a hold. That's 5 yards and an automatic first down. And now we look at it. There's way more opportunity for penalties on a 4th and 15 than there are on an onside kick.
I love fun ideas, weird ideas, because I think all sports get a little bit too bogged down in fear of change. But I think the onside kick is good that it's very rare. It's like it's a desperation move, and it should be hard.
And it is hard.
And when it works, it's amazing. And it does happen once in a while. So,
and it's exciting when it works. All right, let's jump. So that's NFL rule changes. The other one I want to talk about that is the experiment, the Sky Judge experiment. They're going to do it during the preseason. the way this thing is written is interesting because it only deals with a couple of things and they're all already reviewable. Possession plays, goal line plays, boundary plays, issues with the clock. And it's going to be the on-field officials have to communicate upstairs to the replay booth, ask for help, and the replay official has to provide that help before 25 seconds is on the play clock. So you think about the timing of that. Play ends, play clock gets reset to 40, right? We get a ruling. By the time we have a ruling and the officials know what's going on, we may be at 36, 37 seconds. And now you got 12 seconds to communicate upstairs to the replay booth and have replay have definitive video to help you with something. So I get the idea, trying to be efficient, not slowing the game down, but it's going to be a challenge.
That's and quick. I think
ultimately what this, what's going to happen is that's how they write it. In reality, replay is going to be the one communicating first. That's how it works. That's how it happens.
They'll call down to the referee.
They'll call down. And every crew will have that same conversation. Every crew will tell their replay official, when you see something, just tell us. Communicate to us. We're not going to ask. Right? Tell us.
If you see something, say something, right?
There you go. See, now that's a saying.
That's a good quote.
That's a saying I could go with. That's you see that on the subway in New York City all the time. Right. See something, say something, right? Better than your other one. If I don't pay any attention to you, I'm not trying to get you better and I don't care and you suck, whatever else you said. All right, so that's NFL rule changes. All right, let's take a break.
Yeah.
And when we come back, we are going to do the first Good Calls movie review. Okay, Siskel, Ebert, Tamil, Hansen, Madrid, and Blandino. Next on Good Calls. All right, we're back on Good Calls. And I could not be more excited because I feel like this is the first time in history we've known it. I've known Joe for, you know, over 10 years. I've known Scott and Travis for the past, 3.5 years working together. And all three of us have worked together the past 2 years. And never, not once, have we ever all seen a movie, the same movie. We've never. Joe's always like, why do you guys have so much time to watch movies? You know, I'm out, you know, doing my thing and blah, blah, blah. And Travis is like, I don't know why. Travis, just the average white guy. I don't know. How come you haven't seen every movie? And some movies like Rocky, you've never seen. And Scott and I have Scott has seen more than me, but I think Scott and I have pretty much pick up the slack with movies. But I think Scott saw this movie first and
months ago.
Oh my God.
When it came out, like the weekend.
When it came out.
Did you see it in the theaters then?
This movie hard. Like when I first saw Rocky when I was 8 years old, I was pushing Rocky hard. That Monday at school, I was like, you got to see this movie. You don't think he's going to win. And he win or he, you know, it's insane. Watch it. So Uncut Gems with Adam Sandler. Scott went and saw it, said it was unbelievable, said it was worthy of Oscar consideration. Was nominated, I believe, for some categories. It was not nominated for any category.
No Academy Award nominations.
Wow.
That's
okay.
Bull. That is okay. Bull.
No. We're gonna talk about it.
Okay, go.
So Uncut Gems, Adam Sandler. We've all seen the movie now. Okay. So we know Scott loves this movie. He was pushing it. He said it was great. I watched it, and here's a couple of takeaways. I didn't realize, I thought there would be more sports betting references in the movie. There wasn't a lot. Like, he was a degenerate, but it's not like I thought he was going to be laying bets all the time. The movie was more about, and this is a spoiler alert if you haven't figured it out, we're going to talk about the movie. So if you haven't seen it and you want to watch it, still listen because we need the listeners. But just kind of, you know,
if they've got watch this the far, movie, then come back.
If they've got this far, we've already got them.
Watch the movie.
Pause the podcast. Go watch the movie, then come back.
There you go.
It's on Netflix now.
It was more about the opals, right? The uncut gem, the stone. Kevin Garnett. This guy, Adam Sandler, runs. I used to walk on 47th Street in Manhattan in the Diamond District every day. My office was right there. The NFL office is not far. We used to walk down that block all the time when I took the F train. So it's the Diamond District. And what it is it's a lot of shops. You can go get jewelry. There's a lot of Hasidic Jews that run those shops. Adam Sandler, this Jewish guy that owns this shop on 47th Street. And it's it's a jewelry shop. He works in diamonds and watches and all this thing. He has a guy, this younger black guy that helps get him celebrity clients, a lot of athletes. They end up bringing Kevin Garnett into the shop. Kevin Garnett's looking at some jewelry, and Adam Sandler gets this uncut, these opals from an Ethiopian mine, right? From and it's supposed to be, he thinks it's going to be worth $1 million, right? It's like something like 300 carats and whatever it is per carat. And he shows Kevin Garnett. Kevin Garnett falls in love with this stone and basically borrows it. He's in the middle of the NBA Eastern Conference Finals against the Sixers. What are they in, like 2008, 2009, the year that the Celtics either went?
2012, I think it is.
2012? Okay.
Yeah.
That's what the date in the movie was, yeah.
Falls in love with this opal stone and basically takes it. And the whole movie is about Adam Sandler being a degenerate and trying to, he lays these big bets. He owes his brother-in-law money, right? That's his brother-in-law.
Yes, yes. There's a lot of robbing Peter to pay Paul. Like there's a bunch of, he's got bets on bets on bets using borrowed money to front for something else.
Yeah, and the collateral for the uncut gem was the 2008
Celtics,
championship
Celtics three
that
championship
KG gave him.
And he also, Adam Sandler also has a 1973 Knicks championship ring. But Adam Sandler's brother-in-law
it was tiny.
Adam Sandler's brother-in-law is the worst mob boss of all time in that movie. Like he gets the worst.
Yeah, like, he was like tickling him, like, oh yeah, this is what we're gonna do to you.
It was his goons that were the ones that were more of the guys that were pushing. And so the whole movie, look, the highlight of the movie for me, I fell in love with what's her name? Julia Fox.
Yes.
I love her. Okay. I was reading up about her, born
Italian.
In Milan.
Italian.
She's Italian, born in Milan, grew up in, came to New York, grew up in Yorkville.
How do we make this match happen?
Love, love. So if you're listening, I'm single. Hopefully you're single. And I did read that she was separated from currently. I don't know if they were married or whatever, but is currently separated. So let's make that happen.
Right.
I don't know. I liked the movie. It was a very difficult movie to watch at times because it was just manic at times, right? The yelling and screaming, they're in the shop, everybody screaming and yelling. And I'm like, dude, I'm going to lose my mind watching this movie. Like it's making me uncomfortable.
Well, the point of view camera too, and the movement always just moving around.
It is a wall of noise. Like my favorite or the perfect example to me is he's in his office. Lakeith Stanfield's character is like just bashing everything. He's on the phone with his doctor. People are yelling at him.
Yeah.
Like he thinks he might have colon cancer. It's all crazy.
Yeah. And I was like, stop. I need to hear one thing over the other. And it was just really just manic. He ends up, That was the thing that where you knew he was a degenerate when he had the money to pay off his brother-in-law and he locks them in the space between the shop and
like the safety door.
So he can lay the worst bet in the history of the opening tip. Joe,
so scary.
Joe, you
just
understand,
parlay bets in
you
general.
You understand gaming, okay?
Yeah.
Would you ever lay a parlay on a game like that and have the opening tip be part of it? Like, I don't understand it.
I don't even know if
that
they allow you to parlay those types of plays. I mean, I guess somebody will take it somewhere for sure. But it was an odd.
Wasn't it $175,000 and it all hinged on KG getting the opening tip
and
just
then,
to
and
even start
like,
the bet?
Like, he goes, KG wins the tip and he's like, he's yelling at the guy. He's like, that's the one that mattered. That was weird. I was like, yeah, no shit. The movie's over if he doesn't win the tip.
Wouldn't you say, I've seen a lot of movies about gambling and like, poker or whatever. that final bet, even though, because knowing it was that ridiculous, but like, I feel like it's one of the only movies or TV shows, like any entertainment, that's captured that gut feeling of like, you're nervous and scared, but excited about a bet.
Yeah.
I'm not a big gambler. Like the biggest bets I do is like, I'll do $100, like three team parlay, but you're like, so nervous and like freaking out.
I just, if I'm betting $175,000, I'm not putting the opening tip on the parlay. Like I can understand. Okay. You think he basically talks KG. This is Kevin Garnett, who's one of the best NBA players of all time, needs Adam Sandler to tell him nobody thinks you're good because Vegas only says you're going to get 18 points and 7 rebounds.
Yeah.
And so on the verge of game 7 in the Eastern Conference Finals, Adam Sandler is firing up KG to have a good game. Like he needed that. I liked it. I liked the movie. I'll watch it again, especially for her. I just felt like his brother-in-law, he owes him how much money. They basically kidnap him. They throw him in a car. They don't even really rough him up. They strip him down naked and put him in the trunk of his own car.
Wasn't that funny scene, though?
Hilarious. But if I'm a mob boss, like I'm not, and this guy owes me money, that's like giving him a noogie.
He was tickling him pretty much.
Is he a mob boss, though? Because it's like... He's some sort of like in between loan shark type guy.
He's something. And then,
That's why he didn't beat him up though. That's why he is his brother-in-law. He's not. He can't like, you know.
But then why is he hiring these two idiots? And then the guy, they win the bet. He's going to make $1 million, and they shoot him. He shoots him. I was shocked. I was like, he shot him?
I knew that was going to happen when I was watching it.
I can't believe you texted that because I was watching the movie as you were texting.
And then it was the worst crime ever. They shoot Adam Sandler. They shoot the brother-in-law. And then they start robbing the place. Like, they're going to get away with that. There's cameras everywhere. It was just, I liked the movie. The most unnecessary part of the movie was the two guys that look like Stephen Wright, he was smaller and had gray hair, like those two guys.
No, that was hilarious.
But I didn't understand the point.
Like, that added so much. Like it's adding.
It was like,
color.
Wow, he owes these guys money too.
He was an actual degenerate. But they were twins. It was just very weird.
Those had to be real Diamond District guys, right?
It was just all very weird. I love the New York backdrop. I love all of that. I love, his house was in Long Island, all of that, probably in the five towns. I guarantee, they live Jewish community, Syosset, but it was so, I thought his wife was great in it.
Adina Menzel.
The whole interaction with the kids was great.
What did you think about the John Amos cameo? Did you recognize that?
Bizarre.
Right.
Just when he said that, I was like, is he serious? That John Amos, one of my favorite shows growing up was Good Times and Jimmy Walker and John Amos and John Amos, I loved him as an actor. I loved him on that show with who was it? It was JJ, it was Michael. It was who is the sister on Good Times? Oh my God, why am I drawing a blank? There was Willona who lived across the hall. The sister, I had such a crush on her.
Oh, I'm not sure.
I can't think of her name.
I was just like, oh, what a weird, funny.
It was just weird. And then he's like, can my kid use the bathroom? Because I think my girlfriend's in.
And then he's like no.
Like I thought the kid was going to go in. There was going to be pictures on the wall. Nothing. He didn't know.
Real quick, when I saw the movie in the theater with my friend, one of my friends, her mom is Jewish from Long Island. She was saying those family scenes were giving her like PTSD anxiety because it reminded her of like having to hang out with that side of the family. Oh, man. And just how manic it is.
And there's a lot of parallels between a Jewish family and an Italian family. And that was like, you know, I grew up on Long Island. I grew up, you know, I had Jewish friends. So I understand that whole dynamic, and it brought me back to that family, that manic. Like, I just imagine my sister, my mom lives with my sister right now, and they've got three kids and two dogs. And it's just, when I go over there, it's like Uncut Gems all over again. Like, I have to like go outside every half hour just to kind of
get. You don't even smoke just to have a cigarette, right?
Yeah. I'll just smoke. My brother smokes. So I'll deal with my brother if he comes over.
Well, I think the last thing I'll say is just like, yeah, it isn't so focused on sports gambling, but I did like, if you are an NBA fan, there's the, you know, there's like the digs at James Dolan, you know, there's the fun stuff around the edges that feels
and
authentic.
Good. Garnett was really good.
I was surprised with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it helps that he's playing just like a version of himself. But
Adam Sandler's character was so like, just, he goes to the show and his girl, he thinks his girl's hooking up with The Weeknd. So he attacks The Weeknd. Yeah. Like, what?
His girl that he was cheating on his wife with, by the way.
Yeah.
It's like his mistress.
His side woman.
Right, and that's the other thing that didn't make sense. The brother-in-law had to have known he was cheating on his sister. So it's like that he would have already gotten rid of him or treated him much, much worse.
But, you know, well, I think, though, he's married in there. He's not Jewish. That's the thing. But Gozian is it. So it's like that's why that scene also, by the way, I thought Judd Hirsch had passed away. So when I saw this movie in the theater and he's in there, I'm like, good to see Judd Hirsch. But, you know, he's like Judd Hirsch has a lot. And where he's like, he comes into my house and says, "Happy holidays," like I'm a stranger. It's so funny.
The last thing I'll say is, I thought Garnett bailed out on the bid too early. Like he's Kevin Garnett, and he stopped at one night when 10 more thousand was the limit.
Well, he's got that financial advisor, you know, telling.
Oh, you don't go to an auction with your financial advisor. He said the stone spoke to him. He had
flashbacks of his childhood.
Right. I mean, you can't put a price on that.
And he's
Adam Sandler said it was $1 million. Now you're gonna get it for $225.
Yeah. And also what? He's probably earned what, like $180 million in his playing career? So.
NBA, forget it. He came out of high school.
I remember.
Yeah, he got that massive contract.
Absolutely. If we looked at let's look up. I'm looking up what is Kevin Garnett career earnings.
Yeah.
All right. So what's the verdict? How do we rate this? The movie? How do we close it, wrap it up here?
I see career earnings as $326 million. Good God.
Million, and he couldn't shell out an extra $50K for the stone that spoke to him. That is some financial advisor.
That's smart. That's he's rich. He's,
that is some financial advisor. God, you know, God forbid. If I ever made $326 million, oh my God.
And by the way, if you ever do lay a $175,000 bet in a parlay, I want to be there. Can I please be there?
Oh, yeah.
If you ever lay a $175,000 bet, I'd like
so
to book
on
it.
On a scale from let's just do standard scale, 1 to 10. 10 being the best, 1 being the least. Where did you rate it? Scott, where do you have it?
I have it at a 9.
A 9? Okay, that's a high rating because we're talking about what movies are 9s right now. In life.
Well, so I thought it was my second favorite movie of 2019.
High rating.
Wait, what was the first?
Parasite.
Parasite was good.
People didn't love.
I haven't seen it yet.
I liked Parasite. I saw it. It was good.
All right. Nine is high. When I think 9, I'm thinking like, you know, I'm thinking like movies like The Godfather, movies like, you know, when you start getting to those 9-10 range. But okay, Travis.
Well, when I initially thought 7, when Scott said 9, I was like, maybe I could lean towards 8 because I really love the pacing of it. I felt like it was it gave you a feeling like when you were watching it, like that's what you want from a movie. You want it like have something
that
you've never seen before.
It reminded you of your days back in Wyoming.
No, it did not at all. Not even anything like
no,
that.
His night's cruise in Santa Monica.
Cruising when you were drop kicking dudes in flip flops.
Yeah. Coming into my shop, taking my gems.
So what's
like,
the number?
It evoked a feeling from you, and like you had like a different like just
I didn't ask. Movie. I didn't ask okay. for a whole thing. Just give us a number.
Yeah, I'm saying I'm gonna go eight.
Eight, Joe.
I'd go like 6.5, 7. It did invoke a feeling in you, but it wasn't a feeling I was really needing. You know?
No, you didn't need it.
An anxiety like
it
dream.
Something. It's yeah. brought something out.
I anyway, liked
Dean,
it.
What do you think, Dean?
I liked it. I thought it was above average. I'm grading it probably on a harsher scale. I gave it I'll give it a 6.
Wow.
I did like it. I thought, honestly, I like Adam Sandler. I think he's become a really good actor beyond the Water Boys and all those,
Billy
you know,
Madison.
The Wedding Singer and Billy Madison's. I just felt like John Turturro would have been perfect in that role. I just saw John Turturro in that. I don't know.
There's just,
all right, let's, yeah. What Joe, go ahead.
I just thought there were some kind of goofy parts of it. Like the stone kind of was goofy. They could have like the plot and just kind of the writing, but the acting was fantastic. And yeah, it made you feel all anxious, but you know, I wouldn't all watch right. it again.
And from Joe Madrid, let's go Brandon Blandino.
Don't have ID for beer at 7-Eleven. Have to ask guy, dude, you're like 35.
Oh, that happened to me.
When?
When I was like in my 30s and I forgot my ID and they wouldn't give me beer and I didn't do it, but I'm leaving and I'm like, should I ask that guy to buy me beer? Like I thought about it. I was like, I'm going to go home, get my ID and come back. Or should I just ask this guy coming in? And I just anticipated him being like, dude, what? You're 35. Like, why do you need me to buy beer? she wouldn't let me buy beer. I was like, listen, I don't have my ID. I just brought cash. I'm obviously over 21. She's like, I'm sorry. We've had issues. I can't sell it to you.
Well, if you look under 40, they're supposed to card you. Isn't that the rule?
Yeah, like 15 years.
Yeah,
over
but they don't. Legal I mean, limit. They don't really. This, yeah. So I was seriously debating, like, should I ask this guy? Like, could you imagine if some dude came up to you that was obviously, you know, either older than you or the same age? It was like, hey, can you buy me some beer? So yeah, that actually happened.
We should stage something like that again and do it. And you do it again and be like, Dean Blandino asked me to buy him beer.
Yeah.
I had this happen a while ago at a few years ago where I was at going to a bar. My old license had expired. The new one hadn't arrived. And I just forgot the piece of paper. And they're like, it says I'm like 28, but they're like, it doesn't matter. We can't let you in. This isn't valid. And I was, it's like, you're not scanning anything. It just says that, like, yes, it's expired, but it expired saying I'm not under 21.
And yes.
Like, all right. Great. So I just go home. Great.
Okay. Yeah. They're so
fun night.
Ridiculous. All right.
Anything else for the good of the cause?
Don't riot.
Next week, we're going to do numbers 1 through 5. We're going to pick the best athlete to wear number 1 through 5 next week. All right. This has been Good Calls with Dean Blandino. Please follow me on Twitter at Dean Blandino and Instagram at Dean.Blandino. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Rules Podcast. And be sure to rate our podcast on the iHeartRadio app and on Apple Podcasts.
Good Calls with Dean Blandino is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.